Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa. I'm your host. And in today's episode, I'm speaking with psychiatrist Dr. Hector. Dr. Hector and I spoke about hormones and the brain and sexual health, how nutrition can improve brain function, and more. If you like the show, please subscribe and give us a rating or share the episode with someone who might find it helpful. Thank you so much. And as always, if you want help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we are your go-to coaches. Just hit the contact link in the show notes. Now onto my conversation with Dr. Hector. Dr. Hector, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to have you on. I'm really excited to talk about all things sort of hormone related, nutrition related, of course, as well. But before we get into the nitty-gritty, I'd love to hear from you. What's the main thing you're excited for the listener to learn today?
Well, I guess, I mean, as a psychiatrist and brain expert is what I try to tell patients. I want to make sure that their takeaway and what I'm most excited about is the brain controls everything, but at the same time it's a sponge. So, when we think of things like love, sex, hormones, we think it's just something completely not related to the brain, because a lot of the times we think like the brain is like, cognition and like focus and concentration, those kind of functions. But I try to educate people in the sense of like the brain controls all of those emotions. And if it's not healthy, what do you think those emotions are going to be? They usually tend to be not healthy, and it messes up other systems like our endocrine system, our immune system. So that's basically one of the most, one of the things that I'm most excited about, as I educate and teach people about how to take care of their brain.
Very cool. And I love how you brought the metaphor of of a sponge, the brain being like a sponge. So yeah, I'm sure we'll get more into that as we continue our conversation. I would like to hear a little bit about you as well. How did you get to where you are today in terms of what you're doing and everything else?
Well, are you ready for like 3 hours? So actually, before I became a doctor, I was actually a fashion photographer. And it was during my prep sessions with I was gonna say patients, with the models, that I was trying to get to know them, get to really understand them. And most of them were very young. Most of them were females. And they would come up to the photo shoot 7 a.m. after a long night of partying, because it was in Miami, right? So they was just tell me everything. And without even thinking about it, I was doing psychotherapy. And then I started saying, you know what, I want to go back to medical school. I want to study women's health. And that was really was what I was more passionate about at the time. And then towards the end of medical school, my school kind of made me do extra psychiatry electives. And I was like, I don't want to do psychiatry. I want to be OBGYN. I want to do women's health and hormones and all of that. And without knowing, now I look back at all the things that I've done, it kind of brought me to a place now where, as a psychiatrist, I get to also take care of these other systems like hormone systems, because they come from signals in our brain. So it's kind of how I always find it funny, because when I look back, I'm like, man, I was really like pushed along to get to where I'm at now, and all the different things that I've done in my life has allowed me to do what I'm doing today and sharpen all those tools. So I'm very excited where I'm at now and the things that I'm doing. And now with my new practice that we just opened, a lot of it is focused on how we take care of the whole person. So I use the term whole wellness, not just, segmented areas of our body and our brain, but take care of the whole person. And that's what has kind of brought me to where I'm at today. And it's kind of fun at the same time.
Well, that's amazing, and I think it's really there's a big need for blending those two areas of like psychiatry and hormone regulation and so on. And so I'm certainly going to make sure to link your clinic, the White Butterfly Clinic, I believe is what it's called, in the show notes, so people can go and check it out and register online for free as well, I believe. So yeah, but tell us a little bit about that blend here. Many of the listeners are having some hormonal issues, whether it is women having hypothalamic amenorrhea, whether it's just stress-related hormone dysregulations, or perhaps they're going through the menopause transition. So for all of them, how can we understand better how that's affecting our brain and how our brain is affecting that, because of course it is sort
It
of a
all, yeah, it all talks to each other. Well, mainly the big word here is stress. You know, when we think of stress, we tend to think like work and things that we have to do to take care of the kids and our spouse and like all this stuff. We think having all of that is stress, but we don't think about that certain things that we do, our body goes through, are stressors on the body, right? When I think of stress, I think of a change. And not all stress is negative. Not all change is negative. If anything, part of who we are as human beings is we are a ball of change. We're changing every single day, every minute of the day, right? So with those changes comes the worst stress. So what happens to a woman's life, honestly, is changing the most. Actually, in one of the magazine issues that we did on resilience, I talked about the female brain. And how the female brain compared to a male brain is a lot more resilient. And I think a lot of that comes from your constant force to change. Your body is always changing. I mean, the male body always changes as well, but not as drastic as the female body and brain. So, in a way, it sharpens the woman to be more resilient, which, if you look at it, women tend to outlive men. In many areas. So it's always very fascinating to me how the word stress tends to be only seen as stress because of all the things we have going on. But we don't think about that too. So let's, when we talk about menopause, perimenopause, this is a huge time for change in the woman's. If we only stick to her nervous system, there's a lot of things that are going on in their nervous system, but their endocrine system is really driving the car here. When you look at symptoms of perimenopause, for example, a lot of them are actually brain symptoms. Yes, there's the body symptoms, right? But there's a lot of like fog, a lot of just fatigue, weird mood that are off, even personality changes. Those are all brain symptoms. So when I teach my patients and they're like, hey, well, you're a psychiatrist. Why are you telling me about my hormones? It's because, well, first of all the signals are coming from your brain. So if those signals are off, what do you think is going to happen to your symptoms? They're all going to be off. And the more we study, and I'm so excited at the time that we're living in, that there's a lot of doctors are opening up their minds to women's health and how different it is, and diving in and learning more. Because when we were trained in medical school, we were not trained that much of a difference. Yeah, we learned the basics, right? But there's a lot more to just what we were taught. And I think a lot of providers just kind of stop there. And we forget that this is a continuous learning process for us physicians, and we need to do that. And I think the people, especially in our country, are demanding that kind of support. So with that said, I think a woman's body is always changing. There is different obvious phases that we all know and love. I mean, I'm not a woman, but and that's another thing I tell patients, like, I don't have to be a woman to treat your symptoms, right? Sorry.
No, I think there's a lot of great stuff there, because reframing stress, reframing just the struggles that we might embrace as just a natural change, just something that is, there's nothing wrong with you. This is complete, even though you feel like it's not your normal, or like something you're not feeling like, quote unquote, yourself. This is a normal process to go through. And from what I'm picturing it as, with the terms of restructuring, I'm kind of like looking at hormones and just in general the brain structure as kind of like, if we look at an infrastructure systems, and then hormones being the messengers, so kind of like the cars going from one way to another. Now, if you think about a complete restructuring of an infrastructure system, it doesn't necessarily mean it's good or bad. It's just there's change. Like, some roads might be blocked, others might be in construction, and so on. And so while that is being restructured, there might be some detours. You might be feeling some brain fog because the cars haven't quite figured out the proper routes yet. But then once you have gone through the transition or made it through certain times of change, there is just a new layout. And rather than trying to hold on, cling cling on to the previous version of ourselves, of where it was, just kind of like accepting that that's something natural. Like, that's at least what I'm kind of hearing you say, that yeah, there are certain things we can do, of course, to make the transition easier. But just it starts with us accepting that this is a normal process. Is that, would you say that that's kind of correct?
Yeah, and I think we need to continue to educate women on this is a change. And it's not the same for everyone. There's a lot of things that they share, right? But it's not always the same for everyone. The timing is also not the same for everyone. So to say this is what is happening to every single woman, no, I think that would be too ignorant for us to say, because then you want to sprinkle in life stressors, which is obviously very different for every individual, right? And I think, one of the things I tell a lot of my female patients, I'm like, careful not to corner yourself. And what I mean by that is taking on so many things because you think that you have to, because your role before was this is what a woman is supposed to do. But then now women are doing a lot more than they were able to do before. But this is why I tell them, be careful, because you're still a human being who's going through a lot of changes, and you can get yourself to a place of burnout, which is a big bulk of my female patients, what I'm seeing today. They're highly successful. Most of them are executives. They're running the show. But then now they had a baby, and now he's just threw a wrench onto that wheel. And now they start reevaluating their worth, their value. I'm like, no, hold on, time out. I'm like, whoa, we're going down the wrong path. You're cornering yourself. Don't do that. And I'm probably one of the most feminist guys I know. And I think it's because I was raised by what I call alpha females. All the women in my family are like that. So, but just because you can doesn't mean you should. And what I mean by that is taking on more things, right? I have to do the mother role of cooking, preparing breakfast, but then I also have to be the lawyer at my practice and be one of the tough biggest ones there. Wait, time out. You're still a human being who's going through a lot of major changes right now. You have to remove some of those things from your plate. That doesn't make you less of a woman. It doesn't make you less of a mother. And why am I talking about this is because I think this particular issue is what's taking a lot of women to even more hormonal imbalances, because those psychological stressors can really get your nervous system hijacked. And then now you're expected, because I don't like to use the word normal, but your expected changes to happen now are just at a whole other level, because your psychological stressors are really fueling all that stress, the negative stress. So I always tell them, hold on.
I really hope that that sinks in, because this is such an important message. And I think just because someone was able to handle something in their 20s doesn't mean that we have the capacity to hold the same thing or handle the same thing in the 40s or, whatever it might be. And also just realizing it's okay to outsource, it's okay to delegate, it's okay to do less, and actually not associate that whole productivity thing with like self-worth and all these things, which are probably even more, layered even deeper. But yeah, I guess so talking about the whole stress system, I know that often that also affects our libido if we're super stressed. And so can you explain a little bit about the connection between sexual health and libido, including libido and the brain?
Yeah, for sure. So, our limbic system is our emotional system, right? It controls how I regulate anxiety, how I regulate my mood, right? When it goes on overdrive, it's trying to balance a lot of circadian rhythms. And these are the things that I call animalistic things, right? Every animal sleeps, eats, has sex, and bonds, right? And we're not any different. But what happens when our limbic system, our emotional brain, is hijacked because we're so stressed out and we have so many things going on? It's going to kill a lot of those circadian rhythms. So you start having sleep issues. And I use the word issues because people think sleeping less, and sometimes it's sleeping too much, because now you're just chronically fatigued, or you're like, I just want to go and lay down all the time. Another circadian rhythm is appetite for food. It goes off. You might be hungry at the wrong time of the day, or you might not wanting to eat a single pea in the time that you should be actually consuming nutrients. The same thing is with libido. Libido for me is sexual appetite. Do I have the desire? That also gets killed. When these things happen, you have to then really say, okay, hold on, let me see what's going on here. A lot of the times, an overactive thalamus, and that's the part of our brain that regulates circadian rhythms, is the part of our brain that can get information from our environment, right? Right now, I can look outside and it's light, sending signals to my thalamus, be awake. Don't send out melatonin, right? As it gets darker, send out melatonin, go to sleep. But if that circuitry is thrown off because of stressors, and remember we use the word, well, what I mean when I mean stressors, there's psychological, but there's also physical stressors in the body. That's going to go thrown off. I always tell patients, when people go to surgery, surgery is a stress on the body. All those cyclical circadian rhythms get thrown off. Just like if you just went through a major surgery. So imagine if you're going through a major surgery every day, they're going to go thrown off, right? And then I have patients like, doctor, give me something for sleep. Give me something to stimulate because I think I have ADHD. I'm like, no, you're just overstimulated. Let's remove some things. All the amount of to-dos that you have, like you said, need to be delegated most of the time. And guess what? If it doesn't happen that day, it's going to be okay. We got to move on to something else. You got to prioritize. Otherwise, you will get to burnout. And burnout is not healthy. A lot of systems are shutting down after burnout, just like if you had a major surgery. All these systems are shutting down. And not even to mention our GI tract gets really thrown off. So these are things that I always try to educate patients like, hey, your libido is very much tied to your stress levels. I mean, that tends to be a given, right? We all know that we're stressed. Our sympathetic nervous system goes on high drive. I don't want to relax. I don't want to have sex at all. That's just because we're like in fight or flight mode. But if we're in constant fight or flight mode, it definitely directly affects my libido. I don't want to, do anything at all, which is not healthy because, believe it or not, sex is one of the greatest ways for us to increase things like oxytocin that calms me down, relaxes me, allows me to bond with someone, right? But it lowers cortisol, which is the main stress hormone. So you see how, like, by actually improving one thing, you can fix the other one. But you have to, that's when I always go, ladies, okay, time out. We got to stop. Stop everything you're doing. Let's reevaluate.
Yeah, again, like that message of just doing less and often like acknowledging we need to calm down. And instead of adding some pills, adding another workout or adding whatever, really just like stripping it back. And to your point, I think it's not just about the sexual intercourse, it's also about like hugging, being with the people that you love,
Right.
spending quality time. All these things help us calm down, but we actually need to make the space for it. We can't just expect like, oh, I've got 10 minutes with my husband. This needs to be the most profound connection ever,
Hurry.
and we're gonna have a super deep conversation about God and the world. And you know,
No.
that doesn't work. So, aside from these lifestyle things of like taking more time together, when it comes to nutrition, what are some things that we can do on that front to help our brain deal with stress or regulate better so that we might feel a bit calmer?
Well, as simple as if we know the serotonin goes hand in hand with carbohydrates. For a long time, we've been taught that carbohydrates are bad. Well, now we know no, not necessarily, right? It's a lot of it is excess, right? If we do too much of something, then it's the same thing we just talked about stress, right? We too much of something is going to mess up something else. Carbohydrates and serotonin are like best friends. Serotonin and estrogen are like best friends. So when you're craving sugar, when you're like just want to eat the whole fridge at night, that's chances are your body is wanting serotonin. Serotonin is made in your gut and it goes to the brain when we move. So I want to make sure that you're eating good, healthy carbohydrates throughout your day to fuel your brain and to increase that serotonin. What do we know about serotonin is the chemical that controls a lot of those circadian rhythms that we just finished talking about. But it's made in the gut. So we need that amount of carbohydrates to help us make this. So that is as simple as looking at that. When then we look at things like focus, concentration, some of the things that we call the executive functions, like planning, organizing, all that stuff, that's all driven by dopamine. Well, dopamine is made by something called tyrosine. That's an amino acid found in poultry, in anything that is with high protein. So if I notice that we need to optimize someone's executive functions, I need to make sure you have a high protein diet. So when I tell my patient, okay, let's break down your macros. Let's just keep it simple. Later, I'll send you to a nutritionist to dive a lot deeper. But right now, let's just understand these two basic concepts, carbohydrates and the need for protein. Believe it or not, a lot of my patients, everyone tells me the same thing. Oh, doctor, I'm eating healthy. I have a healthy diet. Okay. So then I tell them, okay, let's break down your macros, jot them down for 3 to 5 days, and let's see what your macros actually look like. Believe it or not, people that want their brain wants a lot of serotonin are eating way too much carbohydrates, a lot of fat, and very little protein. So they are living in this cycle. So remember we talked earlier, right? Brain is a sponge. So if these nutrients are not being delivered where they need to be and the amounts that they need to be for you, we're not going to get too far. So I tell them, let's break down your proteins. Let's really look at how much you really should be consuming. You know, every person is a little different, but I always use the 1 pound for 1 gram of protein, right? Let's just keep it simple for now and let's see how you do. Then I break down into like, okay, not just look at what we need to add to our diet, let's see what we need to remove. Anything that is inflammatory, we have to remove. And I tell them to start with three basic things. Lactose stuff, right? So dairy, anything that is high in sugar, especially processed, and so dairy and gluten, right? So these are very inflammatory types of food. Let's remove them for a few weeks. Let's see how you just feel by making that basic change. There's a drastic change that the person feels. And they tell me, they're like, well, I feel lighter. I feel that I can think. I feel more creative. I'm like, yeah, we're just pumping dopamine into your brain, which increases creativity. But we're doing it in a way that it's just as simple as changing a few things in your diet. But then your brain needs, right? Not every brain needs these kinds of amounts for certain things, right? Depends on what the person is trying to work on. But if we understand these basic principles of how food affects our brain, not to mention our immune system and our nervous system, our endocrine system, we do most of the work by just making those changes, especially the removing inflammatory food. That's a big one. They immediately tell me, oh, I had a cake one day after stopping and whoa, I felt like crap. I'm like, yep, you just loaded suddenly too much sugar, you know? So
And now thinking that some of them might have been eating that every single day for
every single day.
years. So, I mean, I really, really like all your explanations. Seems so simple, but it's so true. And the execution of that is a whole other level. Like, just because it's simple doesn't mean it's easy. And from over 6 years of nutrition coaching, I 1,000,000% agree with what you're saying, that I see the same thing in my clients, that too little protein, either way too much carbs or not enough carbs, especially like some of the women that are more active and you know, they're afraid of eating carbs because they don't want to gain any weight. So often restricting carbs around their workouts. And as soon as we like add more carbs around the workouts or add more carbs, especially in the end of the day, they sleep better, they are able to relax and so on. So really, really everything that you're saying resonates a lot. And I mean, I know we wanted to kind of keep it more on the broad movers, the things that really make a big difference. But nonetheless, I'd love to hear from you if there are maybe like 3 to 5 supplements that you do think make a big difference and that you would recommend for most people.
That really depends on the individual. So I'm always very careful of supplement that I recommend. Because, for example, 5-HTP. 5-HTP is one that I use a lot. It's a precursor to serotonin. And that reaction happens in the gut. But if I see that someone doesn't have good gut health and I say, we can't do 5-HTP yet because you're gonna be going to the bathroom every 5 minutes because your gut is inflamed, is on fire, right? Another one that I use a lot is tyrosine, which is the dopamine precursor, right? So tyrosine is a supplement. You can, like I said, you can find it in poultry and in anything that's high in protein. But sometimes patients need a lot more than what's in the food. So I optimize with just tyrosine supplementation. Another one that I use quite a bit is lithium orotate. Lithium orotate, not like lithium carbonate, which is the medication that people tend to associate it with bipolar and mood disorders. Lithium orotate tends to be really good at regulating mood. So I use that one a lot for that. And then another one that I've been using a lot lately is oxytocin. Oxytocin, even though it could really help with things like bonding, so I've used that a lot in patients on the spectrum who want to enhance their bonding abilities. Oxytocin can also be used during sexual interactions because that feeling of bonding, if you are like struggling with it because for whatever issue that hasn't been resolved, then we say, okay, let's optimize a little bit with oxytocin to see how that can help you. And in that area of sexual health and wellness, I've used oxytocin quite a bit and I've been really successful with it. And then another one that is that one I always kind of have it. It depends on the person's cortisol levels and blood pressure is ashwagandha. Ashwagandha has gained some good traction and good popularity, but all these supplements have their things that we have to pay attention to. So, for example, if I know someone that has low blood pressure or their cortisol levels are actually not that high and it's not really related to their anxiety or stress, then I stay away from ashwagandha because it can really drop your blood pressure. So there's a lot of benefits in supplements. I actually use them more even than medications. And I always tell people I'm not against medications at all. I just use my tools at different times for my toolbox. I don't have to use them all at the same time. And depends on what the person needs, right? So these are supplements that are big staples for my practice and things that I use. And then the other one, the big one is GABA, which just tends to just kind of calm the nervous system. The thing with GABA is it needs to be really high dosages to actually cross into the brain. So a lot of people think like, oh, doctor, I've been taking GABA for a long time. And then I look at the bottle, it's 200 milligrams. That's not doing anything. That's not even crossing into your bloodstream. Like you're just like pooping it out. So there's a lot, and I'm excited to be a psychiatrist at this time too, because there's a lot more supplements coming into the market, giving us a lot more things to work with. But the other most exciting thing is they're actually being compared to medications and other modalities to see if they're actually effective. So those are the ones that I have seen to be actually effective, depending on the needs of every individual. So I always do tell, make sure you run that over with your clinician. Don't just go ahead and buy them because it could be affecting other parts of your body and your brain. So, but that means you got to go be working with someone who's well-versed in supplements, understands how this kind of medicine could really be either implementing or better yet, supplementing your current regimen if you're on medication, for example, or you can just do it alone. But always make sure you use someone, a provider that is really well, knowledgeable of the use of some of these supplements. But there's so many of them, and it's exciting to see how they're being compared to other modalities and showing really good benefits.
Yeah, thank you for that caution of like this is not for everybody, and making sure we're getting the dosages right, and especially we probably don't want to take all of them in combination. Sometimes
No, I've seen people do that.
more
I'm
is
like, no,
better.
Tama, we got to get rid of everything.
That's right. So no, I like that you put that note out there. And I wasn't necessarily going to go down that route, but I'm too curious myself because I know it's something you speak about a lot and you're probably very not knowledgeable in. And that pertains to ADHD and just other like neurodivergent people or kind of I guess profiles if you want. And you speak about how that often affects our abilities with relationship struggles as well, or just in general, you just mentioned like sexual bonding or bonding in general. I'd like to hear from you like what are some things, some common themes you see there within people that have ADHD or other neurodivergence?
So they tend to have very similar patterns of brain activity. And what I mean by that is I tend to use a brain scan called a SPECT scan so I can see brain function. For example, people with ADHD tend to have a very quiet frontal lobe. My frontal lobe is my executive, my CEO of my brain, right? So things like planning, organizing, staying on task, focus, they tend to be a little sleepy. So that's why we tend to use stimulation or stimulants to turn on that frontal lobe. That's where I use a lot of the tyrosine, for example, because it turns into dopamine. A lot of ADHD medications are dopamine type of medications. But then I also put them on either a carnivore diet or a really high protein diet. And then I got to look for a bunch of other things to stimulate this person. You know, how does your day look like? Is there stimulation in your day? There's no stimulation? Well, that makes sense why your executive functions are not working that well. So that's a pattern that we tend to see a lot in people, for example, with ADHD. On the spectrum, it's a little different, even though sometimes they could have some ADHD type of symptoms or attention issues, but they tend to get stuck on things. So there's a part of our brain called the cingulate gyrus. The cingulate gyrus is supposed to, when it's working properly, let us go with the flow, right? We're here talking about something, I can switch and start talking about something else and not cause distress in me, right? Someone on the spectrum has a hard time doing that. They get stuck. Right? They almost appear to be obsessive or have OCD kind of behaviors, right? Because they get stuck on something or things have to be a certain way, right? They get stuck on a way of doing something, for example. So that part of the brain tends to be really overworked. So what is it trying to do? It's trying to let this person go with the flow more. So on a SPECT scan, you see it like really lit up, like it's on fire, right? Those people tend to be very argumentative, oppositional. But a lot of people can just have that without being on the spectrum. So people on the spectrum, what they tend to have different from people who are just argumentative and oppositional is they have a very quiet cerebellum. Cerebellum is a part of our brain down here. We call it like, it's like the primitive brain. It's like a little tiny brain that it has a lot of functions. There's still things that we're learning about it these days, but it has a lot of functions. It used to be our only brain. It tends to be quiet in them. Well, that's where socialization tends to occur with the cerebellum. So if I have someone who is very stuck with very poor socialization skills, they tend to be on the spectrum, right? So when I look at someone on the spectrum, I see them as their social intelligence is low. Has nothing to do with academic intelligence. Actually, one of my patients on the spectrum, he's 14, he's in college, he wrote his first book and he's working on his second book. So they can get very stuck on something. You just have to find that thing that they can thrive in. So use that part of their brain that is kind of working against them, use it in their favor. It's just we need to kind of guide that person. And then the socialization piece, we need to enhance that cerebellar activity. And I do that with body movements, like balance and coordination type of movements with music. It tends to activate our cerebellum. Our cerebellum is also the part of the brain that like allows us to balance our body. So when we're walking, we're not wobbling all over the place. It's a part of the brain that when you get drunk, it goes down in activity and you can't like you can barely walk straight, right? That's decreased cerebellar activity. So what do I have them do? HIIT training and a lot of balance and coordination movements, tennis, ping pong, swimming, dancing, okay? Because it's going to enhance cerebellar, therefore increase socialization. So these are some of the things that I work with my patients. But to answer your question, someone on the spectrum tends to have these parts of their brain not working as well as we like them to. So we just got to do what we got to do to help them get to where they want to be.
Yeah, I think that's a really great message because honestly, I've seen people thrive that have ADHD or are on the spectrum, and especially as you say, like if they hone in on what they're so interested in, what they're good in, they're like geniuses. So I think as long as we find a way to like navigate that as best as possible, and would you say that something like music or stimulation, so like let's say going out on a hike with people, is tends to work better for socialization than like sitting across a table very stiff for someone. I mean, that's obviously
Yeah,
like very broadly speaking,
for
but
sure.
I guess you have that simulation. Is
Yeah,
that
being able to stimulate them in a way where they don't necessarily have to speak,
okay,
right?
yeah.
Because that can cause a lot of distress in someone,
Right.
right? So let's do more of like the hiking, for example. I can just go and let the conversation just flow. Because as this person starts working on their balance and coordination, their socialization just starts coming out.
Right.
You know, you just need to give them a little bit more time. I think sometimes when we want someone to be here, we push them and instead of like, let's guide them there. And that's what I tell a lot of my parents when I'm working with them and they have you know, their son or daughter. I'm like, let them get there. Don't push them. You know, we're gonna do all these things to get that cerebellum to work well, but then let it naturally go, right? I sometimes work with social coaches who are guiding a lot of my patients into social interactions. I mean, you look at something like going on a date. For a lot of these people is like, whoosh, you know, it's this huge thing. And we already know that dating is stressful for anybody. So imagine for someone who's struggling with socialization. It's very stressful, extremely stressful. So then let's just guide them there. And most of my patients who are on the spectrum are adults, right? They're either just turned 18 or they're in their early 20s. There's no like therapies are really for them at that age. So they kind of just tell you aged out or like that's it, you're done. I don't think so. I think there's a lot more socialization that needs to occur because that 19, 20-year-old might still be socially 14. So they might be doing something that is not appropriate for a 20-year-old to do because their social skills are at the 14-year-old level, for example, right? So we need to bridge that gap. And so working a lot of times with a social coach, and I have coaches in my practice, and I train them to make sure that these are some of the things that we're working towards, gives that person the tools to then improve their social skills. I mean, these are things that most of us just kind of learned, you know, in high school and middle school. Raise your hand who had a horrible middle school experience. I think we all did, but that was a huge socialization transitional period, right? Everyone was awkward at that age because you don't know what's socially appropriate or inappropriate. You kind of just get thrown in there with the wolves and tell you figure it out. But I'm glad that nowadays we're able to even talk about these things to then say, hey, this could be happening. This doesn't make you know, a weird person or something wrong with you. You don't throw them away. No, let's just guide them, just like if they're tutoring them for math. Let's guide them into this area, right? They don't need academic counseling. They need social coaching. So then let's just guide them there. So these are some of the things that I know and I have seen comparison. For example, you mentioned ADHD and someone on the spectrum. So their brains tend to behave very, very different. We just have to kind of get those areas to work better. That's all.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think it still like it ties in with what we were saying about menopause earlier, or someone postmenopausal and premenopausal, like just different brain structure. Different doesn't mean good or bad. So, yeah, Dr. Hector, thank you so much for everything you've shared with us. I want people to go and check out all your other content. I will make sure to link your socials in the show notes, but maybe you want to shout out your like your Instagram or wherever people can find you best.
Sure. So I'm always on Instagram, but we know there's LinkedIn and Facebook, but my Instagram is the word doctor underscore Hector. And our website is thewhitebutterflyclinic.com. I have our magazine in there, which is a wellness magazine that we started publishing this year. And I'm so excited about it because I get to bridge my photography days to what I'm doing today. And then we also have the Power Up series. And the Power Up series is they're free workbooks that I put together because I notice a lot of people are either hesitant to start therapy, afraid to start looking at these things like confidence, integrity, discipline. So I kind of put these together. They're very short because I do have a lot of people with ADHD. I have ADHD, so I don't like to read long things. And they tend to be about 10 pages long. They're free, they're on the website. They're usually published monthly, depending on the theme. And they're more than welcome to go get them. And they're at thewhitebutterflyclinic.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a true pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Hector. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow. And remember, if you want help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we'd love to guide you. One more thing before you go, if you're looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL for your chance to win a $250 gift card every month. Thank you for listening.